7 FM in Portland. The time is just before 8 o'clock. Up next is More Talk Radio with hosts Cecil Prescott and Celeste Carey. Their guest is social movement analyst Scott Nakagawa, senior partner at Change Lab, a grassroots institute for advancement of racial equity. You'll hear them after these messages.
Wednesdays in Portland are a little more festive these days, thanks to creative collaborations and Hump Day PDX. Hump Day PDX is a street festival in Southeast Portland, featuring the live music and art exhibits of creative entrepreneurs who are living on the streets. There are also family activities to enjoy, food to eat, and a beer garden for drink, all organized by creative collaborations in support of struggling artists and in an effort to stimulate the local neighborhood economy. The next Hump Day PDX is September 11th from 7 to 10 p.m. at Southeast 9th and Belmont in Portland. More information about this KPU-sponsored event may be found at kpu.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. Today is September 9th, 2013, and you're listening to KBOO-FM. That's at 104.3 in Corvallis, 91.9 in Hood River, 90.7 in Portland, and throughout the world, it is KBOO.FM. This is More Talk Radio. My name is Cecil Prescott. My co-host is Celeste Carey. Let me give you our phone numbers so that you might join us in our conversation later on. If you wish to participate, give us a call at 503-231-8187, or you may email us at moretalkradio@gmail.com. And today is September 9th, the first time I've been on air for a couple or 3 weeks.
Yeah, close to 3 weeks for you. I was on last Saturday.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, joining us this morning is a person that many of you might be familiar with, Scott Nakagawa, who is a community organizer, says since 1980. I'm not sure what you were doing before 1980, but as long as I've known Scott, he's been involved in social justice movements. And Scott, thank you for joining us this morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
So are you in Brooklyn or?
I'm in Brooklyn, yes. Oh. I'm in Brooklyn in the Fort Greene neighborhood.
Okay, okay. I have relatives in Bed-Stuy, so.
Oh, yeah, very nearby.
Yeah. So thank you for joining us this morning.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So we wanted to have a pretty wide-range conversation for this hour or so, and one of the reasons we wanted to talk with you was that recently we've been talking a lot about all this activity around the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington, and I know you are a very good analyst and writer, and wanted some of your thoughts on not only what's been happening, but your sense of where we might be going in the future. So why don't we begin by, if you may, sharing some of your thoughts on a lot of the action and talk in recent weeks around the 50th anniversary on the March on Washington. I was wondering if you had any observations just generally on were there opportunities missed or during the recent observances in terms of what did we the media, for the most part, failed to connect with in terms of connecting the dots?
Well, in the March on Washington 50th anniversary was kind of complicated intersection of many different things. I thought that a lot of people in the media used it as an occasion to be able to frame a period of history 50 years since the original march in 1963 and support a discussion about race in America and about racial progress since that time. And I think to the degree that they did, you know, there were a variety of different points of view. Everything from the right to the left of the political spectrum had something to say about it. But I think for the most part, liberal media addressed it as an occasion in which to talk about how much has been accomplished. And I think it's really important to talk about those accomplishments. But I also think that it's equally important to talk about what wasn't accomplished in that period of time. And I think that that discussion was largely absent. I also think that the coverage of the march failed to address the broad scope of issues of concern to us today around civil rights, and really talked about this 50-year period of racial progress in terms of black and white, which I think is important. You know, I'm not somebody who thinks that we should get necessarily totally beyond the racial binary, because I think that we live in the racial binary. But I think that while we live in this reality, that the story of civil rights in the United States is much more complex, and ignoring the complexity of it, all of the other aspects of civil rights struggle and the people who are affected by it, tends to oversimplify the problem, and I think to our detriment.
Well, just because I think it would be important for us to frame what was achieved after we kind of describe what was missed, can you talk about what you saw that was missed? Let's just do that one before I unpack this. What do you feel was missed by both the media and by the marchers in terms of what the civil rights review and memorial could have addressed?
Well, I think a couple of things. First of all, the original march was a march for jobs and freedom. And I think that because of recent developments like the Supreme Court's decision about voting rights and gutting our voting rights protections, a lot of the discussion this time revolves around voting rights, which I think was an organizing strategy on the part of the march conveners, and a smart one. But we didn't talk that much about jobs. Mm-hmm. We didn't talk that much about the wealth gap and what it's made of, about structural racial inequality and why it is that we still, after all of this progress or apparent progress on issues of race, continue to suffer with this racial wealth gap between particularly African Americans and whites, but actually all people of color and white people, and why we have such a tremendous unemployment gap in this country, particularly, again, between blacks and whites, with black people having almost twice as much unemployment within those communities as white people. We didn't talk about the gaps in educational achievement in that context. You know, we talk about these things as evidence of more work to do while progress has been made, but the reality is that since 1963, on these fronts, we've made relatively little progress, and there are reasons for that. And I wanted to see those reasons discussed, why it is that structural racism persists, even as the superficial racism, the kind of thing, sort of consensus on race and the racial etiquette of this country seems to have advanced beyond those old days when overt racial bias was expressed so, widely and so violently.
As you talked, just mentioned in terms of what was missed in terms of addressing the issues such as the job and education gaps, you also, at the end of your remarks, talked about the difference in terms of, I think you used the term, racial etiquette in terms of how we address these issues. I think one of the celebrations themes that I heard often is time is that that we're no longer the country we used to be. And you mentioned the failure to talk about structural racism. Mm-hmm. Could you define that a little bit more in terms of the common parlance when we talk about racist? You know, no one wants to be a racist anymore, but we failed, as you mentioned, to talk about structural racism. Talk about the difference between what you mentioned and what's the common perception or definition of racism.
Well, you know, I think that a lot of people reduce racism to individual acts of prejudice and racial attitudes. You know, so it's really, we think of racism as something that lives in our hearts and minds, as opposed to something that lives within the society that we have created. And, you know, I think it's easy to forget when we reduce racism to simple attitudes and acts, that racism is just a justification for the kind of historical oppression that people of color in this country have experienced. Racial attitudes, racist attitudes, are simply a justification for horrific acts. Acts themselves and the legacy that they create in terms of structural inequality live on, even if our attitudes change. So, you know, if you think of, you know, racism in its original form in this country, in the colonies, as kind of a blueprint for the creation of a society, that blueprint dictated how society would be structured and organized, where people would live, how they would live, what codes would protect certain people and not others. Over time, we've changed our ideas, but based upon that original blueprint, we've created these structures, and we still have to address the structures that we've created and haven't adequately done that. So, for instance, you know, those blueprints, those racial ideas dictate that we have ghettos and suburbs. You know, we haven't actually adequately addressed the impact of all of that. In society today, the thing that most dictates whether or not a child will be successful, the two things are your family's wealth and your zip code. People who live in areas with high concentration of poverty are less likely to experience social mobility in their lifetime than those who don't. It's a simple matter of where you were born. Similarly, those who have parents who are wealthy, and this is not just about income, we're talking about wealth, you know, how much you own, dictates whether or not you will be successful in life more than any other single factor. Wealth is inherited. So in a country where we have had historical racism and the exclusion of people of color from certain kinds of government benefits and programs to promote economic development, that's the inheritance that people of color have. Our children are born into a society in which they will inherit less and are more likely to live in areas where there are high concentrations of poverty, which dictates that they are going to be less successful, because those are the ingredients of success in this society. It's not just about individual initiative. It's about these things that are far beyond our control. Those factors beyond our control, we have not adequately addressed. We haven't dealt with it. You know, for much of U.S. history, and particularly during the time of the, you know, middle of the last century, when, you know, the New Deal and the Fair Deal provided economic opportunity for people and created the great middle class, African Americans in particular and other people of color as well were excluded from those kinds of government investments and programs.
I think
we
it's really important.
We have never had a similar kind of opportunity for affirmative action for people of color. We've never experienced that kind of investment at that scale. And so that advantage, which was a publicly funded advantage, is still part of the inheritance that many white families have that, in particular, black families do not have in America.
I thank you for saying that, and I think it's really important to look at it in terms of not only were they excluded, but legally excluded, so that this particular asset was prohibited, not just not on the table, but prohibited from seeking it. And I think that's a really important distinction that we need to remember as well. And then also when you talk about wealth, I think sometimes people think in terms of hard assets, like maybe land or a house or a job with a good income or money in the bank that gathers interest. But wealth includes the access to these things as well. So, you know, education, as you mentioned, I think sometimes people forget that the access to an affordable and a relevant education is also a wealth factor. And sometimes we forget to look at that, so that when people think, well, I don't come from a wealthy family, or my family might have also been on assistance, they forget that they still had one very valuable asset, and that was access.
Absolutely. Access makes a huge difference, and proximity, right?
Yes, yes.
And so that proximity to wealth also makes a huge difference, Because a huge amount of what equates to success in life is access to social networks of people who have opportunity. And in a society that defines what those social networks will look like largely by race, that means that some of us are excluded from that kind of access.
You're listening to Your Community Connection, KBOO Portland, 90.7 here in the city, 91.9 in the Columbia River Gorge. Point South in Philomath and Corvallis is 104.3. Did I do it right? I always flip those numbers. And www.kboo.fm here on the in the ether. We're speaking with Scott Nakagawa, who is a senior partner at Change Lab. And when we were talking about the things that were missed, you said something, and Cecil also repeated it, but I would like to unpack it for our listeners and then move on to some of the things that you think we've done right. And that was the phrase you used, racial etiquette. Can you unpack that for us? Because I think that when we're trying to reach this much tossed around concept of post-racism and post-racial equality, so to speak, which really baffles me sometimes what people mean by that. But I think it's really important for us to define what our ground rules should be as we try to grapple with this really deep root in our consciousness. And you mentioned racial etiquette. What do you mean by that, and how does it apply to how we deal with our racial heritage and our racial future?
Well, in the supposedly post-racial America, we have a new racial etiquette in which it's not okay to say certain words. It's not okay to display certain attitudes. It's not okay to behave in certain ways. You know, there's a new kind of code of etiquette around race that prohibits us, for example, from using the N-word in public or using other kinds of racial slurs. I think that that's important. But given the kind of inequity that we live with today, that new etiquette is really just a language of post-racial racism. You know, we don't live in a post-racial country. I think that that is really apparent to most of us. We see the kinds of, overt expressions of racism all around us. And we also see the kind of inequities that we've been discussing. If it's not the result of racism that we see these gaps in wealth and opportunity, then what is the reason they exist? In supposedly post-racial America, the explanations are not very flattering of the people who suffer within those, suffer on the wrong side of those power injustices. And so, I think that that's basically what we're dealing with. You know, post-racialism is really just colorblind racism.
And that's a very good definition in terms of colorblind racism. I haven't heard that term before. I think it describes it well. I want to go back a little bit in terms of your observation. In terms of what is missed and what we've done right, one thing you noted in the 1963 March on Washington is that it was a march for jobs and freedom. And in our discussion this morning about the economic factors, points to that. Do you think, in terms of how movements are today, are they making those type of connections in terms of identifying race, class, economic, and other issues to draw people together and to make the movement more powerful?
I think that there is a growing movement among low-wage workers that is beginning to make those connections. And I think a lot of labor and community organizing networks across the country are starting to make those connections. I think what we understand is that the reason we live within the kind of economy we live in that has such, where the bottom is so far from the top, mm-hmm. is because of the kind of history we've lived in which race has played a very important role. I think it's really important for people to remember that at the very beginning of our country, the whole notion that America was a land of opportunity was a race-based meme. It was a race-based theme. You know, the America as a land of opportunity is something that began with original European immigrants who came to this country in order to escape horrible kinds of, you know, systems of peonage and rigid class systems in Europe, in which they were horribly exploited. They came to America and settled here because white people in this country, because of slavery, had the opportunity to be able to own land and become their own bosses. And so America was indeed the land of opportunity for European immigrants. But that opportunity rested upon the backs of African slaves. So that whole notion is part of the culture of America. And over generations, we have continued to exploit people of color in extraordinary ways and exclude them from wage and hour protections that we have exclusively reserved for white workers. And as a result, we have created this whole set of precedents in how we treat certain kinds of people within our economy in terms of labor that we would not have had it not been for that justification of racism. Racism dehumanizes people in the minds of the racist and justifies doing extraordinary things, extraordinary cruel things to those people, among which is excluding domestic workers, for example, from basic kinds of worker protections that others enjoy because they were black. Domestic workers today continue to suffer from that loophole because that loophole was created originally because those workers were black. You know, and so I think increasingly people who are working with domestic workers, for example, see this problem and are addressing it. And I think broadly speaking, people are beginning to address the fact that we live in this society in which race is class. You know, people always, often have this argument with me about, you know, what's more important, race or class. Mm-hmm. I say, well, race is the way that class is lived in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And so in order to deal with class inequities, we have to deal with race. It's a matter of self-interest to all of us, regardless of our race, that we do so. It's also a matter of our self-interest because we want to live in a democratic society. And race is one of the most profound contradictions between the ideal of democracy in America and the reality of life for most of us, even including poor white people. Excuse me.
You are listening to More Talk Radio here on KBOO Portland. Phone number to join the conversation, 503-231-8187. We're speaking with Scott Nakagawa. We're revisiting the Civil Rights March Revisited. And talking about some of the issues that we think were done correctly, the media caught correctly, the marchers or organizers caught correctly in terms of emphasis, are opportunities missed? And we would love to hear your thoughts and your input on how you have also processed this revisiting. One of the other things that you talked about, Scott, was, and I think this is also fundamental, we mentioned the fact that the former march, the first march, was about jobs, and we talked about how that is still relevant today. And then you also mentioned one of the points I think is really relevant, and I count it as a loss, and that is voting rights and how closely tied to not only civil rights but upward mobility voting is. Can you address a little bit about your perspective, both in terms of how the original march handled it and where we are now in terms of the revisited march handling it?
Well, I think it was one of the great achievements of the civil rights movement to address the crisis of voting rights in America. I used to work at something called the Highlander Center, and the Highlander Center in the civil rights era was the organization that created citizenship schools all throughout the Sea Islands and increasingly across the South once that strategy was adopted by the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. And that program existed in order to help African Americans pass literacy tests in order for them to be able to vote. And as increasing numbers of them were able to vote, they became part of a movement to ensure that legally those barriers to voting would be removed. And I think that march was a signature moment in that struggle, and that it really helped to raise the visibility of, the inequities in terms of voting rights of that time. I think that, unfortunately, we've recently had a pretty major setback. I am particularly concerned about that now because we have framed that setback so much in terms of black and white. And I think that that's a real failure of ours. I certainly think that it affects African-American voters in the South in particular. But to the extent that our voting rights are eroded, all of us are affected. For instance, you know, the original 1965 Voting Rights Act created for the first time voting rights in fact for many Asian Americans, you know, because the Voting Rights Act included, language access, which was necessary for many of us to be able to vote. And so I think that we need to look broadly at how we are going to be impacted by all of that and talk about the broad implications of the recent Supreme Court decision. And I think to some extent that happened in this march, and I thought it was a very clever thing that they, you know, the march organizers framed this march around the Voting Rights Act, because I think that we're going to need to be, you know, mounting a major mobilization to ensure that Congress acts as it should in order to protect our voting rights. But I do think that we need to start to think about these issues in the broadest terms possible.
And you're listening to More Talk Radio. We're speaking with Scott Nakagawa, senior partner at Change Lab, and we'll go to our caller. LJ, good morning.
Good morning.
Oh, hey, how are you guys?
Just fine. How are you?
Just excellent. Thank you for opening up this dialogue. Would you guys care to address the Merrill Lynch thing? As you may or may not know, Merrill Lynch just settled a $160 million class action lawsuit for racial bias against Afro-American workers. As you may or may not know, Merrill Lynch is the largest stockbroker in the USA, and their Afro-American workforce is only 2%. But there was a class action lawsuit brought by George McReynolds, who was a broker for Merrill Lynch for like 30 years. And apparently what Merrill Lynch has done was, being a stockbroker is quite a lucrative job. What they did was they moved the Afro-American brokers into clerical positions, and they gave their accounts over to the white stockbrokers. And would you like to address that, please? And is this simply same old, same old?
I think you kind of answered it right there, LG. I mean, I haven't heard it. I'm not surprised. But Scott, would you care to comment?
Yeah, you know, I haven't heard that the loss of that lawsuit being settled. But, you know, I think it's good news, and I'm not surprised.
Yeah, but Madam Scott, and of course, I'm Cecil and Celeste. What Merrill Lynch is gonna do is they're gonna pay this. Well, they've already paid this settlement, and they're not gonna have to admit any wrongdoing. And that is totally same old, same old.
Well, you know, I don't want to get too caught up in that because it's not real close to the topic. But again, it's kind of like, yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong, LJ. I'm happy that they're settling. I don't expect them to admit guilt. We're talking about a structure, a political, a social, and an economic structure that is not designed to benefit folks of color. So the fact that they've gotten this far is, I think, great news. And sometimes you accept your win as it is. Any thoughts, Scott?
You know, I really don't feel like I know enough about the lawsuit. I understood it somewhat differently, but I don't think I know enough about the lawsuit and the settlement that I can really speak to it.
Okay, you guys.
All right, well, thank you
for the dialogue, and have a really nice day.
All righty.
Thanks a lot, LJ.
And we'll go to our next caller. Good morning, Joanna.
Yeah, hello. I was wondering, hello?
Yeah, we're here.
I was wondering if a new form of slavery will be created in this country by the advanced forms of technology or technology now and in the future. And also I'm thinking or wondering about the wars that we are getting involved in the Middle East. Is that going to help create a new slavery in this country? Anyway, I'll get off the air and listen to you. Bye.
Thank you, Joanne. Any comments on in terms of the either the change in economy and how that impact people? You talked earlier about the struggle of domestic workers and low-income workers.
Well, I'm not sure what the caller meant by a new form of slavery. But I will say that I think that, you know, within our global economy, a lot of what the worst kinds of worker exploitation happens beyond our ability to see it, and that to the extent the American empire has expanded through war and conquest, that we create more and more opportunity for that kind of thing to happen. And you know, I think that you know, I'm not sure what the direct relationship is to our the potential of another war in the region and slavery, but you know, I do often think that people think of slavery in these very specific terms as a historical phenomenon that was abolished and has never returned. But in fact, in many different ways, slavery has revisited itself within our economy, either here in the United States or abroad.
Certainly. Continuing our discussion about the March on Washington and moving forward from that, certainly you are aware that after the march, many movements develop, and you mentioned your experience at the Highlander Center, but many movements learned from the Black civil rights struggles of the 1950s and 60s and built upon that. You've written and thought a lot about movement since that time, and one thing that often hear after that time are people saying that people are either taking our rights away, we've gained these rights, and either, and you can fill in the blank, women, gays, people with disabilities are taking over the movement. You've written and thought extensively about the whole concept of rights and those that language. Could you share something about the thinking of some and how your understanding of what human rights mean?
Well, you know, I think that specifically around civil rights, that one of the things that we suffer from is a kind of confusion in the broad public about what it means to have civil rights protections. I think that, you know, for many, the notion of civil rights really pertains specifically to African Americans. But the reality is that civil rights, of course, are the birthright of every American citizen. Even non-citizens in this country enjoy certain civil rights. The question is whether or not they're protected. So for many, many, you know, generations, African American civil rights were not protected specifically because of racism. And the civil rights movement existed in order to correct that contradiction. But the rights that they were fighting for are rights that we are all guaranteed. Not all of us receive those rights and protections, but all of us are guaranteed them as citizens. So the whole struggle around civil rights is a struggle around the definition of our citizenship, who gets to be an American citizen and what that means, and who gets to decide who gets to participate. And so it's really fundamentally, at its heart, a power struggle around how we define ourselves as a people, as Americans. And so, you know, the civil rights struggles of immigrants, for example, are important to us and relate to the historic struggles of African Americans. Similarly, the civil rights struggles of LGBT community members is related to that same fight. It's all about this contest of about democratic accountability and the definition of citizenship and how roomy that definition is, who gets to belong to it, or whether we can arbitrarily exclude people because of our ideas about morality, ideas about race, about gender, about ability, etc. And so I think it's important for us to recognize that there's a baseline, and we need to build and strengthen that baseline of rights in this country, because any time that baseline is eroded or violated, all of us are made more vulnerable, because these are rights all of us have. These are American rights. And to the degree that we're unable to see Black people as fully American, or Asians, for example, as fully American who live in this country, we make ourselves vulnerable to those rights being violated for all of us. Recently, you know, there's been a lot of talk about the, you know, the NSA overreach and how our government is using private corporations to spy on many of us. This is a thing that should give us all cause for concern, but we have to recognize that these organs of repression, this ability to spy, these, you know, this national security state that we've developed has not just developed overnight.
Not at all.
It develops because the rights of certain people have not been protected historically, and so these organs develop, they grow, they become stronger, and as they do, they take on a life of their own. They begin to live off of the very violation of rights that we are concerned about, and increasingly more and more of us are affected. So, you know, whether it's Japanese Americans during World War II or the Black Power movement in the 60s, the, you know, Central America Solidarity movement in the 70s, to the degree that we allow our government to violate people's rights and to spy on us, we help to build the mechanisms by which spying is conducted. And to the degree that we do that and strengthen those mechanisms, similarly, post 9/11, you know, allowing our government to spy on American citizens who are Arab, Muslim, Middle Eastern, or South Asian, we, you know, increasingly create these organs of repression that can turn around and actually grab all of our phone numbers and all of our phone records and start to look at every one of us, making us more vulnerable to having our privacy violated.
You're listening to More Talk Radio. Our guest this morning is Scott Nakagawa. You can follow his blog at racefiles.com, or you can follow him on Twitter, Oh, your name is backwards. Okay.
Nakagawa Scott.
Or you can subscribe to Change Lab.
You can subscribe to Race Files, and you know, you can get there by going to www.racefiles.com. And, you know, at Race Files, we're hosting a number of writers. We're starting to increase the number of people who are writing at the site. And specifically what we're trying to do is talk about the Asian American experience of racism and racism within the Asian American community in order to be able to strengthen, as I said, that baseline of rights overall.
And we'll go to our next caller. Good morning, Charles.
Good morning. Thank you. I'm hoping the guest can talk about ways to keep diverse communities engaged with one another. I was at the local march down on the waterfront, and in 3 days I'll hopefully be joining the father of Keaton Otis to remember how the Portland police murdered Keaton on the 12th of May, and we remember that every month. But I hope the caller can, the guest can talk to us about the unfortunate burden that minorities to have to keep us lazy, latent racist white people engaged in this work of justice. It was great to be able to go down to the march, but unfortunately, community leaders on the black side are working hard, but we haven't heard much from the city club about race, so I was just wondering if the guests would put forth some ideas about how we keep this work going on. Thank you.
Thank you for your call.
Well, you know, I think that it's really important for us, particularly in places like Portland, and I should say I lived in Portland, Oregon for 25 years, and I think I've known Cecil since the 80s. Is that right, Cecil?
Yeah.
And I actually used to be a cable show host way back in the day. I had a show called Boneheads and Bigots, Confronting the Politics of Fear, that was specifically, you know, addressed the at the time rising white supremacist movement in Oregon. But, you know, so I have some familiarity with what, you know, life is like in Oregon and in Portland, and very much love the community there. But I will say that in places like Portland where it's overwhelmingly white, and particularly broadly in the state of Oregon where it's overwhelmingly white, so increasingly, you know, people of color communities are growing there, it's easy to ignore issues of race among white people. You know, to a large extent, people tend to think because the numbers of people of color are small, the reality of racism is reduced by the size of those minority populations. But the reality is that my experience of Portland is that it magnifies it. Having lived in many parts of the country, including Appalachia, the Deep South, and here now in New York, it feels very much to me as though in places like Portland that are overwhelmingly white, that the problem of racism is to a great degree magnified. However, the veneer of liberalism that exists in a place where they're very, where the tensions between races feel smaller because minority communities are smaller, tends to, you know, make it more difficult for us to see racism at work. But, you know, my experience is that the reality is that when there aren't these voices contradicting the majority experience, people of color able to speak up to and exercise power around issues of race, that racism tends to simply play itself out in a way that gets normalized and becomes simply the way that things are done. And it becomes very difficult then to recognize it at work. So I would say that one of the things that white people in a place like Portland need to do who are concerned about racism is to continue to raise the issue over and over again, but not as an issue of people of color, not just as a concern for people of color. You know, we really don't need people doing for us, right? We need people doing for themselves. We want white people talking about race as a matter of racism and obliterating racism as a matter of their own self-interest. I want to hear people talking about how racism is bad for the economy, not just the financial and economic status of communities of color, but for the economy broadly. I want people to be talking about how racism is a threat to our civil liberties, and all of us have a stake in protecting civil liberties in this country. I want us all to be talking about the need to protect our civil rights broadly and why racism creates these opportunities for those who would violate our rights to do so, creating precedents that could in fact affect all of us. If we can get white people engaged in that conversation among white people about how racism is not just a problem of poor people of color, but that racism is a problem of democracy and society, I think we might make some, you know, we might make some real advances.
And we invite your calls here at 503-231-8187 to share your thoughts or questions with Scott Nakagawa. As you are calling, I want to remind you that coming up this morning on KBOO at 9, it's the OMO Variety Hour, a program of social and political commentary from a socialist feminist point of view. At 10 is Air Cascadia with interviews, headlines, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, Locus Focus host Barbara Bernstein speaks with Eric DePlace, analyst with the Sightline Institute, about opposition to the plan for the Port of Vancouver, Washington to build a terminal for oil trains. There will also be a discussion about the opposition to three proposed coal terminals in Oregon. At 11, Roberta Hall hosts Health and Healthcare Forum with a focus on Cover Oregon, the insurance exchange by which Oregonians, individuals, and small businesses can apply for financial help as they select health care coverage that will be required in 2014. At 11:30 on the Radio Zine, host Red Green interviews late local filmmaker Andy Norris about his new documentary film targeting Iran. And we want to thank all of you cable members for your generous support. And if you are not a cable member, guess what? You are invited to become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on the donate today. But right now, we're continuing our conversation with Scott Nakagawa.
And we'll go to our next caller. Thank you for holding. Good morning, Jackson.
Good morning, Cecil and Celeste, and good guests. I have a question concerning economics. I have a bone to pick with the banking industry and gentrification, and how I'm noticing maybe gentrification has something to do with the lack of the banking industry getting involved in these communities to where they didn't have to be gentrified in the first place. And like just recently, just last year, how this rather large class action lawsuit went down and how it kind of fizzled out in the news world, and whether or not the reason I'm asking is whether or not that was at an individual level or whether or not a lot of these orders came down with these subprime loans concerning these communities at large has something to do with the CEOs. And I'll take any of my commentary or any of my answers off the air, if possible.
Scott, any thoughts?
Well, you know, I think that the banking industry is certainly one of the problems that we face in terms of the perpetuation of structural racial inequality. And, you know, when I earlier referenced, said that white people ought to be talking about addressing racism as a matter of white self-interest, because racism is bad for the economy. One of the things I had in mind was the banking industry's practices of around communities of color and how that contributed to this subprime mortgage crisis and the eventual real estate bubble bursting. And we the banking industry created these subprime mortgages specifically in order to market them to people of color, to African Americans in particular, who are vulnerable to these these products because of redlining and because of extraordinary rates of unemployment. And so to the degree that people refinanced their homes in African American communities and took on bad second mortgages, they did so in part because of this extraordinary unemployment rate and the availability of these bad products that were designed specifically to exploit that market. And so, you know, once we introduced those products and they became a way for banks to make money, they started to spread. And many, many of us ended up buying into these subprime mortgages that eventually then led to tremendous instability in our economy and to the real estate bubble first developing and then bursting. And really at the point at which it burst, you know, if the mess, you know, landed on all of us and really ruined our, economy for, you know, in a way that we're still trying to recover from. So, you know, I think that it's really important that we look at these things and recognize that when we make people vulnerable to these things by excluding them or by thinking of them as other than us, by failing to be able to see a cross race to how the economic status and lack of opportunity of other groups of people by race actually has an effect on every single one of us, regardless of race, this is the kind of thing that we become vulnerable to.
And we're speaking with Scott Nakagawa. We're talking about issues that are concern of for all of us. Give us a call at 503-231-8187.
So we've been revisiting the whole March revisited and looking at wins and losses and things done right. I think maybe I'd like to kind of shift the focus just a little bit. You've mentioned this, you've alluded to it before, and in part it is the basis for Change Lab, and that is expanding the whole idea of racial relations in the United States beyond the binary of black and white relations. And you've talked in terms of what white allies can do and the things that what helped move it forward, for example, here in Portland by encouraging white listeners to get up and to challenge the idea that racism is profitable for anyone and especially how it is not profitable for everyone. But I want to talk about how we change our relationships within the dynamic of people of color. One of the things that I really enjoyed about visiting your website and reading your race files blog was that picture of the Asian man standing there with the sign saying "Yellow Peril supports Black Power," and I see that as a strong illustration of building a stronger base, creating multidimensional, if you will, a multilinear dialogue. How do we as people of color start building those kinds of relationships where we look at each other's interests as our own?
Well, you know, I think that, first of all, I should say that Change Lab began as an experiment. We're a grassroots racial justice laboratory that wanted to address issues of race as the racial demography of the United States changes toward 2042, when we ought to be a majority-minority nation. Mm-hmm. And recognize the need for people of color to build bonds of unity across racial differences in order for us to be able to exercise majoritarian power at that point,
right,
and start to achieve some degree of racial equity. And so, you know, since the principals, my partner Soya Jung and I are both Asian Americans, we decided to focus specifically on the Asian American minority in the United States and have been looking at various different ways of educating people about the way that Asian Americans have been racialized and about our peculiar role in helping to create and to perpetuate a unjust racial hierarchy in the United States, or at least the way that we've been manipulated in that process. So that's what Change Lab does, and we do it through a variety of means, including monitoring media and doing research into the community itself, in particular in order to address a couple of different things, and one of them is the model minority myth.
Mm-hmm.
Another is anti-black racism in Asian American communities,
mm-hmm.
and the third is the particular world of role of war and imperialism in building the Asian American minority in the U.S. So those things are, you know, are areas of focus. And, so in all of that, we still recognize that we live in a country that is organized around a black-white racial binary. That's how power has been organized historically here. And we recognize that that's important for us to be addressing and looking at and understanding and keeping at the center of our work. In fact, what we've described anti-black racism as the fulcrum of white supremacy. So if you think of white supremacy as, you know, a kind of, if you think of power in terms of a lever, levers don't have any real power unless there's a fulcrum, something you can mm-hmm. put it on so that you can, you know, actually use that lever to affect real change. And but we also think, though, that while anti-black racism is the fulcrum that gives racism its particular vigor and power in the United States, that among the many levers that have been used is the model minority myth.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we can focus on that just specifically for a minute, the model minority myth, is something that we want to educate Asian Americans and other people of color about because it was an invention of the media in the 1960s. At a time when the civil rights movement was at its zenith, and urban uprisings were happening in African American communities around the country, and were dominating the media, and the white public was beginning to change in terms of the northern white public was beginning to change its attitude about the civil rights movement, moving from support to cynicism. The model minority myth was presented to them via the media, and that myth said basically that while African Americans are out there protesting and in some places apparently rioting, Asian Americans have meanwhile quietly risen to success by being cooperative and hardworking, patriotic, and making real investments and sacrifices in the American project. And use specifically the example of Japanese Americans who were at that point not very far away from mass internment to
mm-hmm.
Speak to this, saying this is a tiny minority of people by race in the country who have been almost to a person put in prison because of their race, and yet was able to rise above that and is now becoming a very middle-class group by ethnicity in America. And the flip side of that story was that black people were a problem minority. So to the degree that there was this model minority, or they promulgated this idea of a model minority, they also promoted the notion that, on the other hand, other groups are not as successful because they're problem minorities who want to only make advancements not through hard work and sacrifice, but through protest and making demands. And so, these are two sides of one coin. And we want to, talk with the Asian American public about it, and we want to talk with other people of color about it, and start to explode that myth. Because it's not at all true that the way that Asian Americans supposedly rose in the United States is the result of simple hard work, quiet patriotism, and cooperation at all. You know, simply not the case. For instance, the reason we have a large and growing Asian American minority in the United States today, really the fastest growing minority by race, is because in 1965, at the height of the civil rights movement, because mm-hmm. of that activism and agitation, the federal government passed the Immigration and Nationality Act, which removed racist quotas and allowed a flood of Asian immigrants to enter the country. And so since 1965, most people who are Asian American in this country, either themselves or their ancestors, first arrived in the United States. And it's the reason we are the fastest growing minority, and it is to a large extent the reason we are, in many ways, the most successful minority, economically speaking, because 1965 opened the door to special visas that allowed highly skilled workers to be drawn from Asia, in particular medical professionals, because of Medicaid and Medicare and whatnot, and the shortage of doctors in the United States, to start coming here. So it created this political situation wherein middle class and above Asians from Asia would be coming into the United States, bringing with them skills that we needed because of labor demands that were created by reforms of the civil rights era.
You know, Scott, that in and of itself is another topic, I think, for a show that we should have and have you come back, because I think it's really important for people to realize that history and to realize that in turn that model myth was turned around and used on the subsequent wave of Asian immigrants who came to the country in the middle 70s and afterwards, because many of them did not have those same assets of education or title or profession. And so they were faced with that same expectation that they're going to be this and not given any services. And I think it's important for us to hear that, because that's the kind of information that will resonate with a lot of our listeners and start building some of these collaborative dynamics. So I'm just going to let you know we're going to be calling you back.
Okay, well, that's great, because I think it's really important to talk about the incredible diversity of the Asian American community. It includes people who are being attracted here now as business investors from places like Japan and Taiwan, and Laotian immigrants who are in the United mm-hmm. States because of the United States secret war on the Royal Lao government,
right.
You know, who are in the United States because the U.S. military made the country of Laos virtually unlivable mm-hmm. for a large part of that population. So, you know, it's such an incredibly diverse community. Yes. And these notions about us being more successful financially even than white people, of out-whiting the whites, as people put it, are actually inflated. They're not really true.
We have another caller here. Let me see if we can squeeze him in. Sorry for the time, Michael, but you're on.
Hey, thank you very much. And, Scott, thanks for this important discussion. Hey, I wanted to just kind of, you know, offer some perspective from, you know, the finance community concerning the profitability of racism. I think there's two distinct truths here that you can take home with you. The first one is that racism in business practice, I think, is highly successful in the near term, but not racism directly so much as it is exploiting people who are easy to exploit. And it's obviously that, you know, there are, when the housing bubble, people, all sorts of people were able to access huge amounts of credit with very little disclosure about the forecast, for their own forecast as well. You know, the mortgage companies loved it. It was easy to make money with no culpability and no disclosure from massive amounts of people. So in the short term, you know, arguably by the numbers, racism is profitable. Sadly, however, we've sort of civilization down a couple of rungs by not identifying the broader issues in our communities where we can capitalize on the strengths of our differences rather than exploit and profit on the weaknesses of our differences. And I know I'm out of time. Thank mm-hmm. you for your call, and I'll take any feedback and comments off the air. Thanks again.
Okay, Scott, you have 30 seconds.
Well, I think one of the key things he said is that, you know, that certain people are more vulnerable, right? Mm-hmm. And because those vulnerabilities exist, most certain people are more exploitable. And because those opportunities to exploit exist, we create the means by which to exploit those people. So if racism makes people more vulnerable to exploitation, the means by which to exploit them then gets created, because profit is the motive. But once those means are created, they don't necessarily limit themselves only to those people by race. They can become, as he said, you know, mechanisms by which people are exploited really broadly. And I think that we need to recognize that and start to try to close those loopholes.
Well, thank you for working to open dialogue and close loopholes. We appreciate it. And as I said, we'll come back and we'll visit a little later on in the fall the issue of the model myth. I think that would be really fascinating for a lot of folks. We want to encourage people to visit your website. So if you give us the URL for your race files and just to get more information about Change Lab, we'll roll on out with that.
Okay, it's www.racefiles.com. And through that website, you can make the connection to Change Lab.
Thank you so much, Scott. I always appreciate your thoughts and your wisdom. Have a great day. Thank you for joining us.
Yes.
You too. Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
And this has been your Community Connection, KBOO Portland. Don't forget, if you are a member, election is coming up very soon for board members. Make sure you have your ballot if you are a member. And if you have not got your ballot, make sure to call during the week, 9 to 5, and talk to the membership coordinator. Also, stay tuned to KBOO Portland throughout the day as we bring you news, information, and entertainment for you.
KBOO Radio, in association with Radio Lost and Founds and the Media Net Web, present a film this coming Thursday, September 12th, at Portland's historical Clinton Street Theater. This month, we feature a film titled Sonic Outlaws, about the Bay Area recording and performance group Negative Lands.
Yeah, we broke the law right now at this very instant, didn't we?
And their controversial album, U2.
Snuggle. He was a little dog named Snuggle.
Thursday, September 12th. For more information, go to kboo.fm on the right-hand side of our homepage under Community Events.
You are tuned to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. Up next is the Old Mole Variety Hour. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Merrillhurst University, where adults of all ages can earn college credit toward a bachelor's degree for knowledge gained outside the classroom, with community service, seminars, and on-the-job training, and more. Listeners can learn more about the information session on Wednesday, September 19th at 6:30 p.m., details at merrillhurst.edu. This program has been also made possible in part by a grant from the Clinton Street Theater, featuring independent and revival films, the Rocky Horror Picture Show every Saturday at midnight, as well as the monthly KBOO Movie Night. Clinton Street Theater is located at the